Okay, ready to go. So I am continuing with talking about the difficulties in meditation, the obstacles, and how to overcome them. And I finished off this morning by talking about how to overcome or transcend the irritation or the disturbance of a sound which comes into your meditation, just by, number one, changing the perception of it. But also, there is another method which will lead me into talking about how to overcome other distractions which you can experience in meditation. For example, how to overcome distractions of aches and pains in the body, or mosquitoes, or heat and cold. And this is using a simile which I have just passed over during the talks already, but now I go into a more thorough discussion. And that is a simile again of a screen, a TV set, because as I go into people's houses, I see the size of TV screens gets bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And now some of these modern TV screens can almost take up half a wall. And I wonder why people waste money on buying such big screen TVs. When I see people watching a little movie on the aircraft on a tiny tablet, the screen is only about this big, or on the back of economy class seats, you have a tiny screen too, where you can see the in-flight safety video. And I've noticed when I watch that in-flight safety video, something quite interesting happened to my perception. Before that in-flight safety video is turned on, I can see the screen and the grey border of that screen and the upholstery of the chair on which that screen is embedded. I can see quite a lot. But as soon as that safety video on the aircraft is turned on, that my sight focuses in onto that screen, and I cannot see the upholstery of the seat, nor could I see the grey border of the screen. All I can see is the screen and its contents. It's as if once that screen is turned on, my mind is pulled in and focuses perfectly into that screen. And so it doesn't matter at all how big those screens are, because your mind just adjusts, or rather your visual apparatus adjusts just to fit in to the screen, so you cannot see the edges at all. It's one of those phenomena, one of those natural phenomena of focusing. When you first look at anything, such as when you first look at me, you may be able to see the venerable to my left, your right, typing and trying to take notes. You may see the Buddha statue on the other side of me. But after a short while, you just focus in, you center. And soon you probably can't even see my knees, my legs, because you're just focusing on the face. This is what happens when you focus. What's in the center of your screen, you zoom in on it, and what's on the edges falls off the screen. And this became a very useful insight and metaphor for understanding how to deal with distractions in your meditation. Say you're watching the breathing, and there's a sound. The reason why it distracts you is the sound is pulled into the center of your screen of attention. That becomes the most important thing, which means the sound of the door slamming is right here, and your breath falls off the screen. You're focusing on the distraction. or you may have an ache in your knee, or a mosquito comes to bite you, and that gets in the center of your screen of attention. And again, whatever you're supposed to be watching, say the breath falls off. So the answer to that problem is so easy once you understand this simile. All you need to do is when you are meditating, if the object is on the breath, keep the awareness on the breath. And if there's a sound of somebody talking, keep that on the edge of the screen. It's over here somewhere, to my left, to my right, but I'm always focusing just on the breath. And the sound or aches and pains is not in the center of my screen. And then what one finds is that the mind just focuses, zooms in on the breath, and that irritation, that sound, even people talking around you, falls off the screen, and you're just left with the breathing, your meditation object. But if you are irritated by the distraction, if you start thinking about why do people talk too much in this retreat center, they are spoiling my meditation. Surely that people never taught when the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree. Yes, there may not be many people there, but there'll be many birds and animals making their noises. There's always noises somewhere. But the Buddha would be focusing on his meditation, zooming in until everything else fell off the screen. So if one understands how to zoom in, it does help many problems in meditation. A mosquito biting is way over there somewhere. I don't focus in on it, I'm still watching my breathing. Or a nimitta, I can see the nimitta over here. Everything else falls off the screen, especially that sometimes when you start to get to the stages of nimittas, sometimes you get excited or afraid. And if you get excited or afraid, instead of watching the nimitta or the breath, many meditators start to become aware of boom, 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 your heartbeat as it gets very, very strong. And it distracts you. Now, how do we deal with the distraction of a heartbeat when you get excited, when it gets very strong? Again, you keep your attention centered on the breath or on the nimitta. Keep the nimitta in the center of your screen. And then you'll find, yes, you can hear the heartbeat. You're not trying to suppress it or get rid of it. You're just not centering on it. Which means that after a few minutes, you're not quite sure when, that heartbeat, it will probably still be pumping as hard as usual. It will fall off the screen of your attention. You will not be aware of it anymore. But you will find whatever you put central, in other words, whatever is the most important, that is what you'll be aware of, and everything else will fall off. So, whatever distraction there is, sounds of people, heartbeat, mosquitoes, don't focus on them. Don't zoom in on the problems of the distractions. Keep zooming in on your main meditation object. I love trying myself out on this, making sure it works. The last time was last September when I went to Thailand to again give a talk at a conference. And there I arrived at Suvarnabhumi Airport. And I was told there was another person coming. Could I wait? Of course. So I waited for an hour just in the very busy airports, just after you come in for arrivals. And sitting on a chair there, and it's not the most peaceful place to meditate, you know, in a big airport arrivals hall. But it was a nice test to make sure I can still do my stuff. So that's exactly what I did. I just focused on my breathing. And at first you could hear the noise of all the people and all the chatting and the mobile phones going off and all of the conversations. But I never focused on them. Just watching the breath, I could hear those sounds. But they were to the edge of my screen. They weren't centered on those conversations. And soon, after 5 or 10 minutes, you can center on the breath, and all those conversations went further and further and further away until they fell off my screen, so I couldn't hear them anymore. And that is a way to actually to meditate. And it's a very useful way. I also remember the time on Ajahn Chah's funeral. There was a time when the Queen of Thailand visited Ajahn Chah's monastery. And it was so busy, there were so many people around, and I was not into just meeting dignitaries in those days, especially when you don't have dinner with them with cheese and chocolate. So instead, I just sat down to meditate with the other monks, you know, from Wat Nanachat at the time. I think I was second monk, the abbot was in some big hall where they could actually see everything. I just was meditating there. And even in that noisy scene, you know, you just focus on your breath until all that noise disappears. You have a bit of peace and quiet in the chaos. And apparently, I was told afterwards, the Queen came to see us. She must have been speaking about something. I didn't know. I didn't hear anything. That was really good, to be able to be so quiet, even though, you know, all this this circus is going on around you. All you do is just focus in and let everything else fall off the screen. Now that is so helpful in many parts of your meditation, because it is very difficult to find quiet places these times. And even if you do find a quiet place, there's always a cricket or something which is making a noise. So you don't put it in the center of your attention and mess around with it. So that is how to deal with some of those distractions which you have. Now we go back to some of the hindrances which actually you read about in the suttas, the 5 hindrances. And one of those hindrances which somebody mentioned in the question time is the old sloth and torpor, which for many meditators is a serious hindrance for them. You're trying to meditate and you fall asleep. Now, one of the reasons you fall asleep when you're meditating is, as I said on the answer to the question, is people are too tired. I don't mean so much physically tired. Maybe I am, because I still suffer a little bit of jet lag, I noticed in the evening. That's why you may have noticed me yawning in the evening talk. It's just, you know, for me it's 2.5 hour difference to where I usually live. So my body thinks when it gets to about 8 o'clock, that's about 10:30 p.m. in Australia, Perth, so my body thinks I should be sleeping now. So I can't do much about that, that's just my body, I just ignore it and just carry on talking. But there are usually some physical reasons why you are sleepy. For example, when I first went to Thailand, I was staying in the jungles. Now you know I was born in London. And sometimes, even now, I'm really hot. And I can still see some people just wearing jumpers and even hats on their head. And I can't understand. How can you wear a hat on your head in this temperature? It's really warm. If there was an aircon on here, I'd turn it on and cool the temperature down by quite a few degrees, because that's my nature. So, there you were in very hot conditions. You know, in a forest monastery in the north of Thailand. It was also very humid as well. And we were taught in those days only to sleep 4 hours a day, total. And I could not do that, but I got down to 4.5, which was, you know, not really enough. So I had not enough sleep. Oh, and the food was not nutritious at all. Even the sticky rice was just not really full of any vitamins, and the frogs, even the frogs were malnourished, and those were the ones which we ate. So I was malnourished as well. Malnourished, sleep deprived, in a climate which I wasn't used to. And of course you felt sleepy in the morning. You couldn't do much about that. It was cause and effect. It was nature. And I realized that because one occasion I was helping with the visas, went down to Bangkok. We were put up in a very good monastery, and we noticed that one of the rooms had an air conditioner. And we got permission to get the key because no one else would use it between 3 and 5 a.m. And that's when we would get up and use that room for meditation. And, oh, it was so lovely to meditate in an air-conditioned room. There was no sleepiness at all. Even though you were not sleeping exactly the same amount as I did in the forest, in an air-conditioned room, your back was straight, your mind was clear. Oh, this was beautiful. I realized it wasn't something wrong with my meditation. Just the climate was not really conducive for clarity of mind. So this is one of the reasons why, that sometimes if you're sleepy, maybe it is because the climate is just too hot for you, or, in the opposite, too cold for you. So it's good if you can, if it's possible, to find good temperature, and even good enough food, and take enough rest, not too much, not too little, so your body does feel healthy. And honestly, that does overcome a lot of sloth and torpor in your body, especially that caused by physical conditions. But the other sloth and torpor is because we are bored, because we don't have enough energy, mental energy, to engage in meditation. And that is where some of the reflections to be done at the beginning of meditation really help. You know, things like Buddhanusati, if you are really inspired by the example, the life of a Buddha, the teachings of a Buddha, then you focus on that, and it's very inspirational. Or if you have done lots of service, like Venerable Metta Vihari, organizing this conference, or by translator, these are wonderful services which you have given. So we do Chaganusati, you know, the giving, the wonderful generosity by giving your time for a really, really good cause. And if you practice and meditate, contemplate on those, soon that gives you a wonderful source of energy which will overcome just the boredom, you know, of your meditation. So that's Chaganusati. But what I have also found, that if you can say these days, you know, you have your machines, you can record these talks. If you have your favorite talks which really inspire you, or like a book of Dharma which you can read and it really hits your heart, inspiration is also a wonderful way of overcoming that sloth and torpor. So many of my greatest meditations have occurred after I listened to a talk by Ajahn Chah, and it was just so incredibly profound and wonderful and inspiring and encouraging that afterwards you'd sit down, your back would be straight, and meditation was so easy. So inspiration is a great cause of overcoming the hindrance of sloth and torpor. But negativity, fault-finding, complaining is a great friend of sloth and torpor. The more you develop complaining and fault-finding and this is not good enough, why do I have to do this? We should not have to have better cushions in this retreat next year, better food, air conditioners, or whatever. Because in the West, it's amazing, so many people are learning meditation. They have high-tech meditation cushions. Not these ordinary cushions. Because there's a market for it now. There's many wealthy people do meditation. They want the very best and comfortable meditation cushions. So you get this huge cushion, and you've got a little remote control. If you want to lift your back, you press that and your back goes up. A little one on this knee needs to come up, it's a bit sore, so this one comes up. If you're too cold, you can press another button and it warms your bottom. If you need a cup of coffee or tea, press another little button and a coffee comes up. Not yet. But one day someone will do that. But at least people know that a little bit of comfort does actually help, because it stops the fault-finding mind. And that fault-finding mind, the reason why it causes sloth and torpor, complaining, negativity consumes so much mental energy. It really, really makes you tired, complaining. Especially, you should all know by now in your life, doesn't matter how much you complain, nothing changes. What a waste of life all that complaining is. So, it's best to do the opposite of complaining, the opposite of fault finding, which is gratitude and appreciation. And if you have gratitude to the beautiful dogs, who are actually making this wonderful little accompanying music to my talk. If you have gratitude for them doing their service, then you find you don't waste so much energy, which means you have much more for your meditation. So, try those inspirational meditations rather than the, what's called the negative, fault-finding type of mind. Then that gives you the boost of energy. You don't get so tired. And it's also to make sure that there's enough exercise for your body, because your body does need exercise, which is why we do the walking meditation. And sometimes I do the walking meditation fast, like some monks in Thailand do fast walking meditation, because sometimes you just need to really get your body pumping the blood and get some really heavy breathing going. And for a monk, because if you don't do much exercise anyway, it's a very useful thing to do, to walk fast on the meditation path. And then when you get your body sort of really strong, then you can go and sit down, and you do have greater energy to put into your sitting meditation. So little tricks to overcome the sloth and torpor. But this trick which does not work is fighting the sloth and torpor. That's what I thought I needed to do, because I thought sloth and torpor was a personal fault. So we try all these tricks to try and stop falling asleep during the meditation. One of those tricks, I'm not sure if you tried this, was a matchbox trick. You would take the cover off a matchbox and put it on top of your head, because that would give you feedback straight away. If you started to nod, the matchbox would fall on the floor and you would hear it, and so would everybody else. Because one of the problems is that we don't know that we are nodding and falling asleep, because we have sloth and torpor, we're not mindful enough. So I tried that. Put the matchbox on the top of my head. And it only took me 3 or 4 days to conquer my sloth and torpor. So I thought. The matchbox never fell off my head at all. And that was when one of my fellow monks, Western monks, took me aside and said, "Brahma Wangso, I was watching you when you were meditating with your matchbox on the head. The reason it never fell off, it's because you were still nodding, but as you were nodding, instead of nodding like this, like most people do, you were nodding like this." Perfectly balancing the matchbox on top of your head while you were nodding. And I've seen other people do that as well. Your body and mind is very, very tricky. You cannot trust it. So in the end, I decided, I'm not going to fight sloth and torpor anymore. I'm just going to let it be. Sometimes I did use my willpower, and you broke through sloth and torpor. It vanished. But what was replaced with was restlessness. So I was sleepy, and I'm not going to be sleepy. I'm going to follow my breath. And as soon as the sleepiness went away, I couldn't stop thinking. So I calmed down my thing, calmed down, then I fell asleep again. It was like two extremes of a pendulum, restlessness, sloth and torpor. And when I managed to stop my restlessness, it swung completely to sloth and torpor. When I tried to overcome my sloth and torpor, it just went straight to restlessness. Oh, it was hopeless, through willpower. But then I said, just let it be. Sloth and torpor, it's not me, not mine, not a self. There's no will in there. It's not my fault. It's not a problem. It's just nature, cause and effect. So I just let it be. And that's when I found my solution to sloth and torpor. I just let the sloth and torpor be. If my body wanted to slump, it could slump. I just let it stay there. And because I let it be, after a short time, only a few minutes, I just noticed, I never did this, my body straighten up, and the sloth and torpor clear up. And when the sloth and torpor did vanish, it was not replaced by restlessness, it was replaced by peace. And then I realized, again, some science of meditation, science of the mind, which I mentioned before, explain this quite well. The two parts of the human mind. There's only one way of looking at the mind. Two parts of the human mind, the knower and the doer. And the reason why you have sloth and torpor is because the knower, mindfulness, has not got enough energy. Because you're wasting it in doing stuff, thinking, struggling. Willpower uses a lot of energy. So I just let it be, which meant I was not giving any energy at all to struggle or striving. I was just totally in the moment, making peace with my sloth and torpor, opening the door of my heart to sloth and torpor, just being with it, without any negativity. Because of that, energy starts to go back into mindfulness. The mindfulness receives more energy, gets brighter and brighter, until the mindfulness is strong enough that it's not sloth and torpor anymore. But it's also not restlessness, it's just peacefulness. I found that insight into how the mind works, the two halves, doing active stuff, and just being passive, just knowing, letting things be. That really gave me a huge understanding in how to meditate and how to overcome the hindrances of restlessness and sloth and torpor. It works so well. So whatever's happening in my mind, I just let it be. I don't feed it. Even some of the opposites of peace, such as the restlessness of lust, which already a couple of monks have talked about. And this was one of my personal experiences as a young man, as a young nun. This is your hormones in your body creates, you know, lust and desire, you know, for sexual stuff. And it was my sixth rains retreat. This was in that tea plantation where I saw those Garuda birds up in the sky. But for me, it was a beautiful monastery, perfect in every sense. But I was there by myself. And after about a month, or maybe 5 or 6 weeks, somewhere around then, my restlessness started getting out of control. It was really thinking too much. And it got so bad that the subject of my restlessness was what I say to the lay community, unmonkish thoughts. I started to think about old girlfriends. I was only 6 years as a monk. Maybe she's still available. Stop it! I'm a monk. I want to meditate. Or maybe there's some more girls out there. Stop it! No, you're a monk. And then you started to think about sexual fantasies. Stop it! You're a monk. And what happened, literally, I tried to focus on the breath and blot out those thoughts. I would focus on the breath with a lot of willpower for maybe 1 or 2 minutes, and all those thoughts would like break down all my defenses, and I'd start thinking about them again. And it was such a struggle. I'm sure that many of you have had the same sort of experience. You know, you want to be a monk, you want to keep your precepts, you're inspired by the Buddha's teachings, but these thoughts keep on coming and coming, and you push them away and they get worse. And I didn't have anyone to talk to, no teacher, because I was by myself, only 6 years as a monk. And it got to a point I was getting really crazy. I couldn't tell the lay people. I was too ashamed to say what I was doing. They were feeding me. This is what I was doing with all their food. But, you know, I was motivated. I wanted to be a monk. I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to meditate, but I just couldn't do it. And I got so crazy one afternoon, the only person I could talk to was a Buddha statue. And so, you know, I bowed 3 times and just did an adhidhana, help. And it actually worked, in a strange way, that I had an idea come up. And the idea was to do a deal. And the deal was, I would allow myself to think of sex, old girlfriends, fantasies, anything, I would allow without trying to stop them between 3 and 4 p.m. in the afternoon. That was my sexy time. The rest of the day, I'll be a good monk and watch my breath and do everything properly. I thought, you know, that's a deal. Mind, if you want to think those things, 3 to 4 p.m. you can. The rest of the day, you behave. That's a really strange deal to make, but that's the only thing I could think of at the time. But it never worked the way I expected. There I was, you know, throughout the day, after the bindabat and the one meal of the day, sitting down there meditating, fighting just as usual. Thought would come and try and chase away. Get out, I'm not supposed to think those thoughts. They would come back again. And that's very tiring. So when it got to 3 p.m. in the afternoon, you know, exhausted. So what I did, like many monks would do, you'd lean against the wall, put your legs out. But this, okay, 3 to 4 p.m., you know, I have lots of satya paramita. If I make a promise, I will keep it, unless I'm really hindered, so it's unable to keep that promise. That's why I don't make promises very easily, Venerable Metta Vihari. I know you keep saying, when you're coming back, I say, I'll think about it. Because if I make a promise, if I say I'm coming back, I will. Because that's what I've been trained as, keeping my promises. So, 3 to 4 p.m., I had to keep my promise. Sexy time. Any thought comes, I will allow it, I won't stop it. I will let it be. And leaning against the wall of my hut with my legs out, for the next hour, I watched every breath without any problem at all. No sexy thought came in at all. And that just really shook me. How come, when I say you can come if you want to, I was just watching the breath. When I was trying to push them out, they kept coming in with much more force. I got a lot of insight from that. Some of the reason why you're restless is because you try too hard to be still. You're actually feeding the restless mind with your negativity, pushing things away. And if you let things be, which I did out of desperation, okay, if you want to think like that, you can. And then I just watch my breath so easily. That changed a lot of the way I meditated. So whatever happens, just let it be. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. Just let it be. Stop controlling it. Then your mind does not run away from you. It stays with you. The reason why you have those thoughts is you're trying to escape from the present moment because you've been too hard. Restlessness is your mind trying to escape, run away from you. Why? Why does anyone want to run away? If you have a friend, if you have a humdrum who's really nasty and cruel, always criticizing you, telling what to do, oh, it's so difficult to stay with a senior monk like that. And you can't wait to run away. But if you've got a really kind humdrum, a really wonderful teacher, so wise, so compassionate, always wanting to make sure you're okay, anything you need, anything you want, and as always, never criticizes you, who wants to run away from a person like that? And that's one of my other experiences. Mentioned this monk Ajahn Tate earlier on. He was supposed to be an arahat, and if anybody was in Thailand, other than Ajahn Chah who I live with, and I know for certain. But this monk, he just looked like an arahat. He behaved like an arahat. He was just the most perfect monk to go and visit. But I can't be sure because I never stayed with him, just visited him for a few days. But I visited him, he had a wonderful reputation. He was one of these monks who, when I first went to Thailand, that he was in the hospital in Bangkok with cancer, incurable cancer, even because he was the most senior disciple of Ajahn Mun, who was really popular at that time. He got the very best medical treatment. And the doctor said, nothing more we can do, you're going to die soon. And so if I'm going to die, I want to die in my monastery, I don't want to die in Bangkok. So he went back up to the northeast of Thailand, just outside of Nong Khai. That was about another 25 years when he died. There's sometimes experiences like that, doctors don't know much. But he was a beautiful monk, and so when I knew that he was, you know, probably an arahat, I had all these questions as a young monk, like, you know, you have your questions, and really important questions, get a really good answer from someone who really knows. But when I went up to see him, he was the one, that lady who said, he said, to the lady, said, oh, that means I've got fourth jhana, really crazy lady. But he was such a kind monk. But when I went up to see him, waiting for a while to get my opportunity. And then as soon as I went into the room where he was, my mind went so still. I couldn't think of any question at all to ask him. And I didn't want to ask any question. The feeling which I had was this guy had so much peace and love and compassion. He said, even though I was a stupid young monk, you know, lots of defilements, I felt totally accepted that he wouldn't harm me or hurt me or challenge me or criticize me at all. And that was so attractive. My mind went blank. I couldn't remember any questions. I didn't need to ask any questions. All I wanted to do was just hang out with this monk. And a thought did come up. Said, they're going to have to drag me out of this room. I want to stay here forever. Because it was so peaceful when you had experiencing so much metta, unconditional acceptance. He wasn't fighting me, trying to change me. He was totally accepting the stupid white monk for who he was. And that, in those few moments, took away all my defilements. Felt so peaceful when the defilements were treated with acceptance rather than with rejection, negativity, ill will. That also taught me something wonderful on how to deal with the restlessness, negativity, sexual thoughts of your mind. If you could only accept them totally, 100%, with no blame, then they will vanish. You give them negativity, and then you feed them. Which brings me on to the next anecdote, based on a story in the Devaputta Samyutta. And it's the story of the anger-eating monster. It's one of my favorite ones. It's funny, but it's also so relevant to meditation and many other things in your life. So the anger-eating monster starts off with an emperor who went off to a retreat somewhere in the highlands of Sri Lanka one day. And when he was away, a big monster came into his palace. And the monster was so frightening that all the security guards, they froze in terror, and they went into the cupboards to hide under the tables, behind the flower pots. Even though they're supposed to be protecting the palace, they were too frightened to do so. It reminds me of a story when I was in Los Angeles, and there was a terrorist scare in Los Angeles airport. And just like in the old movies, you saw the police car coming up with the sirens wailing, and it came to a halt on the sidewalk right in front of me, and the doors flung open, and two policemen came out with machine guns. And they ran up the stairs to the higher level, and they had to stop halfway up. They were out of breath. These were flat, fat policemen working for Los Angeles Police Department. As my driver said, too many donuts. And these were the people who were supposed to be protecting United States. Any real terrorist would laugh seeing these policemen so fat. They tried to be the part, rushing out, rushing up the stairs, and they got halfway. But anyway, this was the story. It is an interesting life as a monk. I see some wonderful things. And there we go, the monster that was so frightening, so terrifying, the security just disappeared, allowing the monster to go right into the throne room and sit on the emperor's chair. And as soon as it sat on the emperor's chair, that is when all the other security guards, they came out, soldiers came out, ministers came out and said, "Get out of here. That's not your chair. You don't belong there. Get out. Now. Get out." And at those unkind words, that monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And that just made all of the guards more angry. Get out, get out, get out. Threatening all sorts of bad stuff for this monster. But every unkind word, unkind deed, unkind thought, the monster just grew bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And that was when the emperor came back and saw this huge monster in her palace. So frightening. You know, you think that yakka was frightening. That's nothing. That's like a little kangaroo, just cuddly compared to this monster. And it was so smelly, it stank so bad, that even the maggots crawling on its skin vomited. Even they could not stand the smell. And the emperor was in that position because he was the wisest. He knew straight away what to do. He said to that monster, "Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming to visit me. Has anyone got you a drink yet? We have delicious Sri Lankan tea. We can make it with lots of milk and condensed milk, tinkiri." There's a few Sinhalese words I know, the important ones, like tinkiri. And would you like something to eat? And he was sincerely kind. And at every kind word, kind thought, kind deed, the monster shrank another inch. And everybody in the palace realized their mistake. They were getting angry at this monster. "Get out of here, you don't belong." So instead they were kind to the monster. Some of them gave the monster a foot massage. Monsters are really huge, so it took about 10 of them just around one toe. Another gave them a neck massage. Monsters got these huge heads. You know, you've just got your ordinary head and you get sore necks and sore shoulders. So that was just so pleasant for the monster. And they asked if he wanted anything to eat. And they were so kind. I don't know if here in Sri Lanka, you have pizzas in Sri Lanka?
Yeah.
Because pizza you can get monster size. Appropriate for a demon that big. So they ordered a monster size pizza for the monster. And every kind word, kind deed, kind thought, the monster just shrank another inch, until it was soon back to the size when they first came in. And they never stopped with the kindness. And soon it became so tiny, one more kind word, and the monster shrank completely away. And that's based on a story in the Devaputra Samyutta, and that's called an anger-eating monster. Give it anger, and it gets bigger and worse. And honestly, if you ever do see a real yakka, you give it anger, and it gets bigger. If you give it kindness, and it shrinks. They are anger-eating monsters as well. So, what does that mean for your meditation? I was giving anger to my restless mind. Get out of here, you don't belong. That's not a thought a monk should have. That's what made it bigger and stronger. So after a while I just let it be. Oh, I'm going to be kind to you. If you want to come, that's fine with me. It's not my mind anyway. It's not my thoughts. There's no one in here. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. It's all because of some causes. So I'm just going to let it be, no matter how embarrassed I am to think thoughts like that, and be kind. And that's what made that monster vanish. I didn't feed it anger and ill will. I fed it kindness. That is how to overcome so much of your restlessness. If you do that one or two times, you find it works, and you understand what I mean. For many of you think, that can't work. If I'm kind to my lust, it will just get worse. It'll get worse. I've got to stop it. Does that work, stopping it? Try to be kind to it. It's just cause and effect. And then you find it gets less and less and less and less. The anger-eating monster simile works for many, many of the hindrances to meditation. It's not real proper striving. It's negativity. It's aversion. It's the second hindrance you're practicing. And that will never lead anywhere except to more suffering. And there are other more subtle problems and obstacles in your meditation. And I'm going to go further, not just the obstacles at the beginning of meditation, but the more subtle obstacles when you get to stages like nimittas or delightful breath. Because sometimes people come and say, I've been doing the delightful breath and nothing happens. I've been following your instructions, Ajahn Brahm. I've just been sitting here letting it be and nothing happens. And I say, you haven't been letting it be. You've been wanting something to happen. That's why it hasn't happened, stupid meditator. And it's called like expectations. Expectations is one of the most subtle hindrances. You expect something to happen. Especially you've had a good meditation a few moments ago. And you expect the next meditation to be good also. Did I tell the story of the workman going to work on Monday? Okay, thank you. I give so many talks. I can't remember what I talked about when I first came here. It's not many teachers can give two or three talks a day for about 8 or 9 days. So you're going to bound to repeat myself sooner or later. But anyway, this happened in Australia. There was a refugee. I'm just making this up. A refugee came to Australia. And he was highly qualified. But you know, refugees, if you're highly qualified, you have to do whatever work you can get. So he got a job on a building site. Just pushing wheelbarrows, just doing cleaning, anything. And after one day of hard work, when he went home, his wife said, how much did you earn today? And he said, nothing. I wasn't paid. And he went to work the next day. Same thing happened on a Tuesday. He returned home without any pay. And also on Wednesday, he didn't get, he worked really hard, didn't get any pay packet. And so he told his wife, I don't want to work for these Australian building companies anymore. They just make you work so hard and they don't pay you anything. And on Thursday he said, I'm not going to go. But his wife forced him to go. Go, 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 go. So he went there, worked hard, same thing happened, didn't get any pay. He only went to work on Friday because he had nothing better to do. And on Friday afternoon, the boss, his foreman, gave him this big pay packet. And he went home and he told his wife, "I now understand how it works in Australia. From now on, I am only going to go to work on Friday." Now that's like a person who wants every meditation to be really deep and peaceful and blissful. When just like that man should have realized, you get paid on Friday for all the work you did on Thursday, Wednesday, Tuesday and Monday as well. When you have a nice deep meditation, it's like you being paid for all those meditations you've done before. All those meditations you thought were hopeless, were terrible, you never really got anywhere. That's like the man working Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday without the pay packet. And then you get your pay packet. You cannot expect every meditation to be payday. So carry on. The paycheck is in the mail, as they say. So, but we always expect, and I've told a few people, because sometimes they've knocked on my door, if it's my breakfast or lunch and I'm not ready, and then they knock on the door again, I say, "You're a monk, be patient." Canti paramanta potitika. You know, patience is one of the highest, or the highest, spiritual practices. But in order to understand the problems in meditation, there are two types of patience. First is the wrong patience. That's waiting for something to happen. That is not patience. That's waiting in the future. You've lost the present moment. You're looking for the next moment or a few moments ahead of yourself. Waiting for something to happen next. So you're not actually aware of what you're doing right now. And that expectation spoils many meditations, especially in the deeper stages. Don't wait for anything to happen. Your job is to be aware of what's happening now. And learn how to be content with what's happening now. Because expectation, waiting for something to happen, is a sign of discontent. And it's the discontent which to me is the biggest problem in the deeper stages of meditation. Even though some people have got these beautiful nimittas and they're not content with that, they want something more. They want the jhanas. Come on, isn't this good enough? Blissing out with a beautiful nimitta. That's good enough. Who do you think you are getting jhanas? Nimittas is good enough. You find people do get the first jhana and think, "Oh, I'm not content. I had first jhana last time. I want second jhana this time." Actually, people like that never get jhanas. They're just too demanding. They want too much. It is the wanting which causes discontent. And that means you never get anywhere in the meditation. Try that. I was just trying that this afternoon. Sitting down there meditating and just reminding myself, this is good enough. I'm going to be content where I am, just watching a breath. Not even beautiful breath yet. Just watching, I'm going to be content. This is good enough. That contentment gave me a huge boost of happiness, of piti sukha, which, you know, drove me deeper into the meditations. You will find that many of your problems in meditation because you want something more. As a little one-word, one-sentence saying, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And that's like the Four Noble Truths. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So if you want to enjoy your breath and turn into a delightful breath, and you want something more, it never turns into a delightful breath. the wanting disturbs the peace. The leaf on a tree last night, it only moves because of the wind, the wanting. That's what makes your mind move. So learn how to be content wherever you are in the meditation practice. Let go. Many of you, because one of the nuns in their interview said this, and it's so common. They said they were meditating, but when they lay down to go to sleep, this beautiful light came up in their mind. Why? It didn't come up when they were meditating. Why did it come up when they were going to sleep? It's just like many of my disciples on their retreats. You see them meditating in the meditation hall, they're falling fast asleep. And in the interviews, they complain that when they go to bed at night, they can't go to sleep. And I say, well, the answer's so easy. When you're in the meditation hall, try to go to sleep. And then you won't have any sloth and torpor. When you go to bed at night, try to meditate, and you fall fast asleep. Now you'll understand why. It's because it's similar to the story of Ananda and his enlightenment, which you all will know, I hope. You know, he was meditating all night because the Sanghayana was coming tomorrow, and 500 people were at this big meeting, 499 arahats, and Ananda was the only one who wasn't. Imagine what that must feel like. To understand what it must feel like, imagine at the end of this retreat, I announce that you had all got jhana except for, say, Metta-vihāri. How would you feel, Metta-vihāri? Oh, this really, I did all the work and everyone else gets jhana and this is not fair. That's only jhanas. And so poor Ananda, he was the only one who hadn't got enlightenment, arahatapala. Everyone else had. He was just so, that's not good enough. So he decided the night before to meditate all night, not to lay down and go to sleep at all. He meditated, sat and walked. And imagine, he was with the Buddha for 25 years. Imagine the teachings which he had, the instructions. He had everything. And he tried and tried and tried all night. And you all know, the dawn came. Nothing. He was just as unenlightened as when he started. So what did he do? He decided, well, there's an hour left. I'll just take a nap. And before his head hit the pillow, he got arahatapala. That's why some of you monks, you have a sleep at night and a nap during the day. That's called the Ananda method of enlightenment. The more times you do that, the more likely it is, probability, that you might get enlightened. Keep hitting the pillar. No, not this time. I have to try it again. But the reason why that happened was Ananda was trying so hard to become enlightened. It never worked. He let go of trying. He gave up. He wasn't trying to become enlightened anymore. And that's when enlightenment happened. So, that nun, she was meditating all day, trying to get enlightened, trying to get something. But when she went to bed, she let go. Nimitta came up. That happens so often. Why can't one have that same mind state? No, before you go to sleep, just letting go, relaxing, not trying. When you're actually meditating, you won't fall asleep. But you might get some very, very deep meditations. Because you're not trying anymore. You're not expecting anything. You're not wanting anything. Personal experience, can't go too far because I try not to say too much about personal. After my first deep meditation, it took me 3 years to get it back again. That was frustrating. You know why? It happens to many people. You have a beautiful samadhi. You can't get it back again. Why? And so it was obvious. I wanted it back. When I wanted it back, that wanting was stopping me. So after a while, you realize that and you just let go. So I said, why did I get that really nice meditation first of all? Because I wasn't wanting anything. I didn't actually know what I was doing. It was just a bit of luck, chance. No, beginner's luck. So I decided to not want the deep meditation anymore, but just to want the causes. In other words, contentment, peace, just relaxing. And then those meditations came back again. Because I realized the biggest obstacles was wanting them and expecting them. And that becomes very difficult when you get really close. You get your limiters and jhanas is just the next step. Yes! Oh dear, it's gone again. That excitement, expectation, fear. How do one overcome that? Because whatever you do, those deep stages of meditation disturbs everything. So the way to overcome that, I mentioned it previously in the context of anyone who gets into jhanas, you can actually decide how long you're going to stay in those jhanas as long as you make an adhisthana at the beginning. I'm going to go into the jhana for 1 hour, or an hour and a half, or an hour and 23 minutes and 30 seconds, if you want to play around, and it does work. So, you use the adhisthana if you have problems with excitement or fear in the deeper stages of meditation. If it's always the case that nimitta comes up, you get excited and it disappears. Comes up again the next meditation, it vanishes because excitement comes up, you spoil it every time. What you do the next meditation, after you've got yourself in a good posture, settled your body, you make an adhisthana. If the nimitta comes up, I will not be excited. If the nimitta comes up, I will not be excited. If the nimitta comes up, I will not be excited. I usually ask people to repeat that 3 times. In your own words, your own language, don't follow my words, paying as much mindful attention as you possibly can, and then forget it. By that time, it's got into your subconscious, and it's amazing how powerful that is, how well it works. You're getting to the nimitta stage, you're about to get excited, and this subverbal thought just pops up. I won't get excited. And you don't. It's like giving yourself instructions that don't disturb the mind, because the instructions were given earlier on, and now they come up and do their work. And that's so powerful to use at those deep stages of meditation. I call it programming your mindfulness, to tell it what to do when certain stages come up in the meditation. So, fear coming up. Tell yourself, when I get to that particular stage, the nimitta becomes just so blissful, I will not be afraid. When that stage comes up, I will not be afraid. When that stage comes up, I will not be afraid. Program that into you on that meditation that only lasts usually for the one meditation. And when you get to that stage, it's beautiful how it works. You don't get excited at all. You don't get afraid. And it allows you to go smoothly into the jhanas, because at those stages, if you say anything when the nimitta's up, you spoil everything. You can't say anything. Say it beforehand. And that overcomes these obstacles to people. And for me, they get so far. They're on the door of jhanas. It's so close. And they blow it every time because of fear, excitement, and they don't know how to overcome that fear, excitement. Those is the best way I've ever found to overcome the hindrances of fear and excitement at the deeper stages of meditation. And, of course, overcoming all is the, sort of overarching all is the Four Noble Truths. I think I said this at the beginning of the retreat, but now I'm going to repeat it again. To understand the overarching hindrance to developing deep meditation and jhanas is tanha, craving, wanting. Wanting leads to suffering, to disappointment, to frustration. So I tell my students, if you've had a meditation and you're disappointed, you're frustrated, there must be only one cause for that. You've wanted something. That's why you experienced dukkha. But I call that second noble truth meditation, wanting, and that leads to frustration. But if you practice third noble truth meditation, I call it, you don't want anything. If you get delightful breath, wonderful. If I don't, doesn't matter. I'm going to work. I'm building up my credit. Soon the paycheck will come. I'm making good meditation karma. And the vipaka must come, sooner or later. So I'm just sitting here, just making peace, being kind, being gentle, not wanting anything. Letting go of wanting and craving and desire and aspirations. I'm letting go. That is the cause for the end of suffering, the end of disappointments, frustrations. So if you've had a very delightful meditation, it may not have been limiters or even delightful breath, but you're happy afterwards. Congratulations, you have done third noble truth meditation. Not wanted anything. If you don't want anything, you'll always be content, satisfied. And that is the greatest cause of peace. Just like that, Ajahn Tate. He didn't want anything from me. He wasn't trying to change me or enlighten me or improve me. That's why he gave me so much peace and stillness. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to achieve anything. And I felt so peaceful and still. He answered all my questions just in that one meeting. Because he showed me how to be peaceful and still by not wanting anything. If you understand that, meditation is so easy. And all the obstacles just vanish away. Your sexy thoughts, they just don't even come. Where are they gone? I don't know. You try and stop them, and they keep on coming. And sometimes people say, well, I tried that, it didn't work. You weren't content. You were trying to get rid of them again. Only you tried a trick. I will follow Ajahn Brahm's method as long as they go away. You're trying to get rid of them. So you have to really not try at all. And literally be content. Happy if they come. And they don't come. So there we go. How to overcome the obstacles in meditation. So now you know how to overcome all the obstacles in meditation. The next meditation should be jhana, easy. No problem at all. Have a wonderful time. Okay, very good. Okay, so now we have interviews. And hopefully I can blast you with some loving kindness so you come into the room and you don't say anything at all. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Okay, that's my expectations, which is going to cause me suffering, because it's not going to happen. Very good.